Good afternoon, everybody. If those people who are trickling in could take a seat, that would be wonderful. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. My name is Meghna Chakrabartia, and I'm co-host of Radio Boston at WBUR. And we, oh, thank you, my one fan. Yay. But I'm happy to say that that I'm not the point today. These two stellar people sitting next to me are. But I just wanted to say very briefly that, of course, WBUR is very proud to be a presenting sponsor of Boston Book Festival every year. If I have the number, or at least this year and last and the past several years, if I have the number right, some 30,000 people come to this event, which is just, I think, a hallmark of what a great community we live in, that tens of thousands of people come to celebrate books and writing. For a day on a beautiful autumn day. But anyway, that aside, thank you so much for coming to this conversation today about lives in the law. Seated next to me is Professor Alan Dershowitz, and he's had a long and storied career both in the classroom and in the courtroom. I'm not actually going to go through his whole biography because it would take up all the time that we have, but his new biography, or memoir, autobiography, how would you prefer we call it?
Autobiography.
Taking the Stand, out now, and Professor Dershowitz has told me to tell you about the stellar review that he got in the Boston Globe today. So take a look at that as well.
Maybe the only one.
and next to him is Judge Nancy Gertner, who has an equally long and remarkable career in the courtroom.
Okay.
Well, in terms of impact on how on the law and how it shapes our lives, both cases that Judge Gertner has tried as an advocate and then heard as a judge. Hopefully we'll hear about some, we'll hear about quite a few of those today. But her memoir, In Defense of Women, is a terrific read. Nancy was actually on our program, Radio Boston, talking to Anthony Brooks, my co-host. And I encourage you to pick up both of these books, because as much as I'd like to say we will cover a lot of ground in the next half hour, there's no way that we're going to cover as much ground as is revealed in both of these books. So definitely recommend both of them. So first of all, welcome to both of you. Thank you so much. I just wanted to start with a couple sort of really basic questions about your early lives and what brought you into the legal profession. So, Judge Gertner, let's start with you. At what point in time in your young life did you know that you wanted to be a lawyer, and why?
Well, at first I wanted to be president of the United States, not to put too fine a
not
point
too
late. That. That's right.
Not too late.
Not too late,
exactly.
Right. And I literally remember calculating that first I should run for Senate or the House. There were no women models, obviously, so I wanted to be Abe Lincoln, right? This was an interest which was so out of proportion to my parents' ambitions for me, which can only be described. And so to finish that, so Abe Lincoln ran for the representative, and before that he was a lawyer. So I figured I would start with a lawyer and move up the chain, and then I got stuck at that particular run. But this was so not encouraged by my family, so out of proportion to what my parents thought a woman should do. I love to say, Alan and I both went to Yale Law School, that when I got into Yale Law School, my mother sadly looked at me and said, "Nance, you've priced yourself out of the male market." Right. So there was no encouragement for this particular path.
So presidential ambitions, that's good.
That's
and
right.
Like Professor Dershowitz says, it's not too late. But what about for you?
Well, no. The reason why Nancy will not, I predict here today, will not become president of the United States, which is a terrible tragedy, I tell the reason in my book. And here is the reason. I tell the story about having dinner with Hillary Clinton when I first met her and asking her why she didn't go to Harvard Law School. And she said, "Harvard didn't want me." And I said, "Oh, that sounds terrible. Harvard is, you know, should have picked." She said, "Oh, no." She said, "Harvard admitted me. I had two letters of admission, one from Yale and one from Harvard Law School. And I went to a Harvard dance with my then boyfriend, not Bill, and Lincoln's Inn dance. And I showed the letters to a Harvard professor, Professor Richard Baxter, it turns out, and said, 'Where should I go?' And he said to me, we have about as many women as we need at Harvard. Yale is a much more suitable place for the mentality of women. You ought to go there. And as the result of that, she went there, met Bill. If she hadn't, Bill would never have become president. And now she is likely to become president, so she's taken your position. Your classmate.
She was my classmate, right.
We had very similar upbringings. First person in my family to go to college. My rabbi in high school said to me, Dershowitz, you got a big mouth but not a good brain, so you ought to pick a profession where you have to use your mouth but not your brain. Two choices. You should either be a conservative rabbi or a lawyer. I wasn't smart enough to be a rabbi, so I became a lawyer. I always wanted to be a lawyer. Never occurred to me that there was any other option, and I didn't know there was anything but a criminal lawyer. Of course, Perry Mason, all of those guys, I wanted to defend only the innocent. That hasn't worked out. Coming from Brooklyn, though, yeah. You know, it's street smarts, it's aggressiveness, it's fighting. So law was the natural.
Well, let me ask both of you then. So, but there are many aspects to the law. What was it about, you know, civil rights, First Amendment issues, criminal defense that, I mean, beyond Perry Mason, that really drew you? I mean, in this day and age, I have a lot of friends who've been to law school, and for a whole variety of reasons, even though their heart might be in civil rights litigation, for example, they go into corporate law.
Right.
I was caught by all the movements of the 60s, right? I was in college in the midst of the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and the anti-war movement, and I got completely caught up in that. I thought for a while that I wanted to be a fancy professor at a fancy law school, but I couldn't stay in the library. And I got completely engaged in this. Another Moshe story, I love to tell this one. Of course, again, there was no support for my activism whatsoever. The first time I marched against the war, this is in my book, my father and I had this huge fight. I told him I marched against the war in Vietnam. And he said to me, Nance, it's one thing to believe in something. It's quite another thing to do something about it.
I had the identical story. When I was 13 years old, I had to commute to school on three trains, and I got off one of the trains in Borough Park, and there was a little guy named Soblin who was asking people to sign a petition to save the lives of the Rosenbergs, and who had been sentenced to death for spying for the Soviet Union. I read the petition. It made sense. I signed it. Some gossip in Borough Park told my mother. My mother called me in and said, your life is over. It's going to be on your permanent record. J. Edgar Hoover is going to find out about it tonight. And said to my father, who was a very timid man, slap him. My father didn't know what to do. The only time in his life, he slapped me for signing a petition for the Rosenbergs. So my parents had the same attitude. Think what you want. You know, I think it's part of the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition is very different than the tradition of this church. The Jewish tradition, you don't have to believe in anything. Atheist, shmatheist, as long as you come to the synagogue. So it's not about beliefs, it's about actions.
Right.
And that distinction,
right,
I think, is resonated with both of our parents.
Okay, so early in your career, you know, even during law school or after law school, when you're clerking, whenever, who was one person that really, whether a judge or a lawyer, colleague, who really had a profound impact in shaping what you thought the purpose of legal practice was?
That's hard. There were no women mentors except one criminal defense lawyer in New Haven when I was starting. But, you know, the icons were Thurgood Marshall and the people. The best way to describe it is that you knew you were getting these rather extraordinary skills, and you wanted to deploy them for social change. That was very much, and so Thurgood Marshall was one icon. I mean, I remember the first time I was working for Mobilization for Youth on the west side of New York, doing social change law reform for poor people. And I remember how excited I was by that. I was on the subway, and you know how your image comes up on the subway, you see your reflection. And I was sitting there talking to myself, going, there goes fighting attorney Gertner. And I was so excited by that. So, I mean, I think it was multiple models. there certainly was no model of a life in law.
Right.
That, and certainly no model of a life in law for women. Which is why my parents were so discomfited by all of this.
All of my heroes disappointed me and continue to. And I don't think people should have heroes. And I write in my book about how heroes disappoint. Thurgood Marshall was one of my heroes. Turned out to be a deeply, deeply flawed human being in his personal life and in his encounters with other people. I got to know him late in his life, and he was, as many of my other heroes, deeply, deeply flawed. I would say the man after whom I modeled my life most was not somebody I could easily identify with. He was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant named General Telford Taylor, who was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg. And I saw when I met him as a professor at Yale that you could do everything. And I'm afflicted with a terminal disease called FOMS, fear of missing something. My friend in the audience here, Elisa, who's a psychologist, gave me that term, and it fits my diagnostic category perfectly.
Me too.
And Telford Taylor was a law professor, Columbia at Yale, great litigating lawyer, public intellectual, wrote popular books like Grand Inquest, and I wanted to be Telford Taylor. And I have to tell you, Telford, among the many, Telford never disappointed me. And one of the great thrills of my life was when he was in his 90s and beginning to have Alzheimer's. He asked me to come on the stage with him once for a speech he was giving about Nuremberg, and he said he would forget and he would lose his train of thought. And I knew him so well. We had been to Russia together, to Israel together. We had fought against much oppression in the world. He said, "Alan, I want you up there to correct me and lead me toward the right way in which I have to speak." He was unembarrassed about his failing memory and the fact that I could, being 25, 30 years younger than him, help him at toward the end of his life was so meaningful to me. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the many things that I found were points of overlap in terms of your respective careers and your approaches to what it means to be a member of the legal profession comes in the form of not being afraid to embrace controversy. Mm-hmm. Let me start with you on that, because, and this is something that Anthony asked you when you appeared on our program, about your defense, your 1975 defense of Susan Sachs. And for those people who don't remember the case, she was an anti-Vietnam activist, robbed a bank in 1970, and that resulted in the shooting death of a police officer. So, not an easy case to try, or to defend, I should say. What made you want to take it?
She wanted, this was a time when no one wanted a woman criminal defense lawyer. Nobody at all. I was doing wills and praying for people's souls because I was so bad at that. I like to say that we both went to Yale Law School. I thought dying intestate was a disease. This is absolutely true. So nobody wanted a woman criminal defense lawyer. She, for the wrong reasons, wanted a woman lawyer. The wrong reasons in the sense that she thought her case was hopeless and that this would be her last moment on the stage. And she wanted that last moment to be consistent with her values as a feminist. So even though I, didn't know where to stand in a courtroom, she was going to choose me. Why I accepted the case is another question, and that's actually a function, I think, of the mentality of women of my generation in a way. I somehow felt we all probably narcissistically believe we were carrying the burden of the entire generation on our shoulders. And if you turn something down because you were afraid, people would draw the wrong conclusions. So when she asked me, I literally felt, even though I was scared out of my mind, mm-hmm. I felt obliged to say yes. And it was an extraordinary decision.
And she did a phenomenal job. She took one of the gutsiest decisions I've ever seen a lawyer take, nonetheless a lawyer in her early 30s. She made the decision after the prosecution rested and put on what many of us thought, I followed the case very closely, was a relatively weak case because the prosecution was sitting and waiting to put on the rebuttal case after Susan testified, took the stand, or put on a defense case, and she took the decision not to put on a defense case and thereby preclude the prosecution from putting on a rebuttal case. And as I told her after that, If she had lost, she would have been regarded as the stupidest lawyer in the history of Massachusetts. Having won, she was correctly regarded as the smartest lawyer in the history of Massachusetts, and she did exactly the right thing.
But also, this also speaks to his support of me, which meant an enormous amount. So when you talk about heroes, I started down this path without him, but there were not a lot of people cheering on, you know, this 12-year-old lawyer representing someone accused of murder, and he was one of them.
But you asked about controversy. I love controversy. And
shocking.
Newsflash.
Jesus said, love your enemies. He didn't mean it in the way that I love my enemies. I just love to get my enemies back. And I love my enemies list. I love them so much. The blurbs on the back of my book is the first time in history anybody has ever put negative blurbs on the back of the book. It starts with, I don't read Dershowitz, Jimmy Carter. He's deranged, Glenn Greenwald. This is Noam Chomsky. Dershowitz is not very bright, and he's strongly opposed to civil liberties. And it goes on and on and on. And then it
Justice
has a quote.
Scalia's back there,
and then
too.
A Scalia quote. You're not as nasty a guy as my right-wing friends believe. So I love my enemies. May they live and prosper.
Well, let's talk about this for a second, because in the introduction of your book, you write, I mean, I could hear you say it when I was reading it. You may have witnessed my public persona, confrontational, unapologetic, brash, tough, argumentative, and uncompromising. These characteristics have provoked strong reactions. Yet those who know me, family, friends, colleagues, hardly recognize the character. In my personal life, I shy away from confrontation and am something of a pushover.
Absolutely. I am. My family calls me Pushover Dersh.
Why the dichotomy?
First of all, I am so energized and engaged in my public confrontational life that when I come home to my wonderful wife, who's sitting here in the first row, Carolyn, and she's just wonderful and supportive, I don't want to fight with her. Sometimes she gets upset. Fight back. Be a man. I'm reserving it. It's very different. You know, when you're on television, as you know, you have 20 seconds to make a point, and you have to make it quickly, and you have to make it sharply. In real life, there's more time, and, you know, my real life's more important than my public life. Although the book is called My Life and the Law, the first part of it is all about my private life, and how my private life and my early life really led me to where I am publicly. I say that ideology is biography. Where you stand and who you can't stand is a function of where you sat, who you sat next to, and these are all interrelated. And the purpose of this book is really to try to relate my well-known public life to my unknown private life.
Well, Judge Gertner, let me follow on with that with you, because it's one thing to be a true advocate, right, and to pursue those beliefs and values that are, in your deepest core, in the courtroom. But then you went on to sit on a federal bench, right? And I mean, and I read in your book that you worried that your previous identity as a courtroom advocate, that your new identity as a judge threatened to obliterate all traces of the earlier one. How did you make that transition?
That's the next book.
And buy it.
Right, that's the next. I mean, it was, and I've been thinking a lot about that. In one sense, it was easier for me to become a judge than many other people. I knew precisely what I believed in. In other words, I did not pretend, as some well-known Supreme Court justices have, that I was born without opinions, right? That I was born, I mean, I knew exactly what I believed in, and I would get, if there was a case before me, I would understand where my heart was, and I could then struggle with that and where the law was. If you don't know what your biases are to begin with, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And then they hide and they're masked in the outcome. It was for me, there were times that I would have to do something as a judge. I'd go back in the lobby and say, that was outrageous. That law is outrageous. And I never wanted to lose that observation, that passion.
Well, but for people today, Professor Dershowitz, you think lawyers who may be on the path towards the federal bench, do you think someone like Nancy Gertner could be appointed today?
Absolutely not. And it wasn't easy for Nancy to be appointed. She was regarded at the time of her appointment as the best criminal defense lawyer in Massachusetts, and perhaps one of the best since John Adams. And that's an accurate description. And there was some opposition, as there was opposition to others who were appointed by both Obama and Clinton. And Nancy did a phenomenal job, and I can tell you why, because she disappointed some defense attorneys. They thought that she would go straight down the line, always favoring liberal values and favoring the defense, and she called it as she saw it. But let me tell you about a remarkable transition. You know, sometimes people who are good defense attorneys make good judges. I have never before, Nancy, seen a case of a judge who has come back and become a superb criminal defense attorney. I have never seen that. When judges leave the bench and become practicing lawyers, they tend to be pompous, impossible, lazy, and difficult. And let me tell you, when I had one of my most complex murder cases that I'm still involved in, Nancy had just left the bench, she was the first person I called and said, Nancy, I need you to try this case. I'm not a trial lawyer, I'm an appellate lawyer. I need you to trial this case to avoid me having to be the appellate lawyer in this case. And Nancy came back, and it's as if she had just been a criminal defense lawyer again. She was there, she knew her role, there was no pomposity, there wasn't call me Judge Gertner, there wasn't call me this, call me that. It was terrific, and she is back. Nancy's back, and she's going to be the best criminal defense lawyer again. And it's a remarkable ability to transform from roles.
Well, there's one more question about this that I'm going to ask, but I'll circle back to it about your life as a judge. But before we leave courtroom experience entirely as a realm of conversation, worst moment in court so far?
Worst moment was when I cross-examined a policeman in a murder case by making him think we had him on tape, admitting that he did something we knew he did but wasn't on tape. And believing we had him on tape, he admitted what he had done. And I wasn't sure whether I had crossed over lines or not, and I was very criticized for it. As a result, 5 guilty murderers went free. And the judge called me into the courtroom and said, something terrible has happened here. Somebody in this courthouse has elevated technicality over justice. A woman has been killed here, and nobody is going to pay the price for it. And he looked at me and he stared me down. And he was right. He was right. 5 guilty people were going free because I had used my legal skills and maybe had even crossed a line. It turned out I didn't. I went right up to the line, which is what you're supposed to do. But it left me very, very uncomfortable. Of course, I was very fortunate because the person I was working with on the case was Nancy's partner, Harvey Silverglade, who assured me I hadn't crossed any lines, and Gene Baker, a wonderful, wonderful legal team. But, you know, it was the first time I knew for sure that I had gotten guilty murderers off. And what they had done was absolutely outrageous. They had planted a bomb in the office of Sol Yurok to protest what was going on with Soviet Jews. And, you know, their goal may have been admirable, but their means was terrible. And I was part of that process of bringing about an unjust result in order to emphasize constitutional boundaries. Now, I've had that happen to me since, but the first time it happens, it can be devastating because I was a real idealist and I didn't understand that idealism, there's no free lunch with idealism, that there are costs imposed on defending the Constitution. When we defend the rights of Nazis to march through Skokie or the rights of pornographers to spew out sexist filth in the interest of the First Amendment, we are accepting costs, and when you grow up, you get older, you understand those costs, but as a young idealist, those costs are difficult. You probably, I don't want to speak for you, but you know, Susan was not an angel.
Right.
She did participate in an armed robbery, again, right, for idealistic right reasons, in which a wonderful police officer ended right his life, and you helped free her, as I help free comparable people.
Right. So was there a time where, as Professor Dershowitz says, the cost of that idealism you felt was particularly difficult to bear?
Sure. And, you know, it's very interesting that both of us come up with the same kinds of situations. It's not a moment when you felt personally you had screwed up or something like that, but a moment when you understood that your skills, which you had to use to the nth degree, was taking you to a point that, in fact, you disagreed with. You know, it's sort of like the notion of, when I talk about being a judge, as a lawyer, you have two narratives in your brain. One is what you think is the right result, and the other is what advocacy demands. And being a judge was a version of that narrative. I mean, for me, it was representing someone accused of rape. I had been pure. I didn't want to represent anyone accused of rape. And then towards the end of my career as a judge, after I had two small boys, there was an accusation of rape, which is in my book, which against a young man.
And my book, too. This case is in both of our books.
Oh, is that right?
Right.
I should be careful. I should look.
Uh-huh. You're in it.
But it was, you know, there was an accusation of rape against him, and it seemed improbable. The circumstances were improbable, and I was a feminist. I'd worked for law reform with respect to rape, but this case seemed different. I still didn't represent him in the trial. He loses at the trial. He's about to go into jail. I'm doing the appellate argument, and as anyone who does appellate work knows, you have to do everything for the client. I took a position which I thought was a nuanced position even in the brief. His conviction is then reversed on a ground with which I disagreed, which hurt the movement that I was a part of. And I ultimately helped work to change that, but it was a moment where it was clear advocacy was one thing, and you represent a human being, and you have to do what is ethical towards that end.
Well, I've been given the last question flag here, which is just a shame. There's so many more interesting things to talk about. But I was also supposed to tell everyone that following when we wrap up here, if you could just refrain from mobbing our friends, because they have to make their way back to the book signing area. And if you have questions for either Professor Dershowitz or Judge Gertner, they're happy to take those questions during the signing. So again, I got, you know, 25 questions here, but I was looking for a case that I thought you two might disagree on. I was searching for one to see if I could find one where you stand on different points of view. And I'm not sure if this is it, but there's a current case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear called, let me see if I want to get the case name right. Hang on, it's on the last page of my notes. Yes. McCullen versus Coakley. Now, this is a case that actually emerges from Massachusetts about the 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics. There's a group of people who are challenging the existence of that buffer zone on basis on saying that it limits their right to free speech, because obviously political protesters have to stand outside the zone, and non-clinic workers have to stand outside the zone too. So this is a case that, I don't know the date, but the courts agreed to hear it. So it's a case about access to abortion facilities and free speech all at the same time. Professor Dershowitz, let me just start with you. I mean, is this a place where you think there should be a bound to free speech?
Well, I was asked a few years ago to defend an anti-abortion group that was being prosecuted under the RICO statutes. And, of course, I myself personally strongly believe a woman's right to choose and abortion clinics and all of that, but I don't believe in using the RICO laws against protesters.
RICO laws, the racketeering law.
Influence, making serious criminals out of people who disagree over policy. I'm very much opposed to Move On's efforts, for example, yesterday, to try to criminalize the shutting down of the government and to try to prosecute people, just as I was opposed to prosecuting Bill Clinton. I think reasonable restrictions relating to medical facilities are perfectly reasonable. I was just trying to measure in my mind 35 feet, and I think a 35-foot barrier sounds to me quite reasonable. What you don't want are protesters being able to be heard by the women who are actually having abortions or being counseled. You don't want it to interfere with the process of medical treatment. I'll tell you the case I have a real problem with, and that's the case in California now, where they've made it a crime, I think, for doctors to try to talk gay people out of being gay, or ministers or whatever. I think that poses, I mean, I think it's outrageous for people to try to talk people out of being gay. But look, you're allowed to talk somebody out of being Jewish.
You're allowed to try to proselytize.
Right, if you criminalize that, you got to criminalize the other.
And so I have a real problem with that. Look, I'm always somebody who favors the free speech aspect of it, but I'm not averse to reasonable balance. I don't think the 35-foot barrier really places enormous restrictions on the right to protest.
You know, we don't disagree.
Right.
We don't disagree. The abortion issue, when you have to put this in context, the 35-foot restriction doesn't begin to compare now to the restrictions across the country with respect to choosing, to the right to choose.
To access.
It's like I went to sleep 17 years ago when I became a judge, and I woke up in a world in which the fundamental premises of Roe v. Wade are being attacked, and we are, I think,
but here we
within
do
minutes.
Here we do disagree, I think. In my book, I make the case for a woman's right to choose and the legislative right to choose, and I do make the case against the Supreme Court constitutionalizing that right. I can't find in the Constitution the right to an abortion because I don't think it's a right of privacy. I think it's a very complicated balancing between a woman's right to choose, particularly in cases where a woman's health and welfare and life are not in danger, where it's pure abortion from choice. I do think that a fetus, earlier viability, all of that gives a plausible argument on the other side. It is not a gay rights case where there's no
Come
argument on the
Gertner.
Other side.
Totally You've got to disagree.
I know. We disagree on this. Read both of our books and make up your own mind.
We totally disagree. And in fact, I mean, I agree in one thing. I mean, I think Roe v. Wade was a flawed decision. I think it was a discrimination issue.
I do too.
I think it's a discrimination issue. If you mean for women to have all the roles in society, you have to begin to support their ability to choose when to be a mother, whether to be a mother, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a discrimination issue, and I think the courts had to step in and have to step in now because the legislature is what we have seen the past couple of weeks, dysfunctional.
Well, and that's a very good point. And, you know, I think reasonable people disagree. I just don't know where the limiting principle is and where you find in the Constitution. I think the discrimination argument is a very, very powerful one, but I think it may go too far. I'm not convinced. I think the Roe versus Wade itself is very dangerous opinion because as viability becomes easier and easier, a woman's right to choose abortion may diminish over time, whereas the discrimination argument doesn't contain within that limitations on its ability.
Right.
So I think that's very
persuasive. She's trying to end
well,
this.
Well, I was just saying how wonderfully appropriate it is to end on a note where there isn't total disagreement. Uh-huh. I feel like I'm the judge in this case, and I'm just going to...
Your ruling is?
My ruling is that we will reconvene at a later date. But Judge Nancy Gertner and Professor Alan Dershowitz, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sweetie.
And once again, they will be... they'll be in the back to sign as many books. They're fabulous books, both of them, and I encourage you to read deeply. Thank you.